All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Thanks for coming. Thanks for being here. Welcome. Welcome. Sit over there. Just hang out for a minute, will you? Today's Thursday, if you're listening to this when it comes out. And tonight, October 10th, I'll be at the Miriam Theater in Philadelphia. Tonight, tomorrow, Friday, October 11th, I'm at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. And Saturday, October 12th, I'm at the Schubert Theater in Boston for two shows. So there's a few tickets for all of those. The second show in Boston, you should come to that, even if you don't live there. On Friday, October 18th, I'll be at the James K. Polk Theater in Nashville. Saturday, October 19th, at the Tabernacle in Atlanta. And Saturday, October 26th, at the Masonic in San Francisco. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets. On the show today, I'm going to talk to Jackie Tone. Jackie Tone is Melrose on GLOW. She works with me on that show. You can watch her in all three seasons of GLOW. She's also a stand-up comedian. I did go to the premiere of El Camino, which is the Breaking Bad movie. Just by coincidence, I've been watching all of the Breaking Bads. And I just finished them last week. And I got invited, I guess because I'm on a Netflix show, to the premiere. And I rarely go to those things, but I'm like, I want to see that movie. So I said, yeah, I'll go. And they sent a car, which is exciting. I was never one of those people that would take the cars that they sent. I'm like, I'll just drive. I mean, I have a car. I live in LA. What do I need a car service for? Because it's fucking great. How's that for a reason? They just pick me up and then they'll take me home and I'll have to find parking in Westwood and wonder, you know, how do I get into the, where are my tickets? Where am I? Can someone help me amidst the chaos? Drove right up. But then you got to, like, you know, you have a choice. Do I want to take pictures? Do I want them to take pictures of me on the red carpet? Because part of me is sort of like, it's not my movie. I'm not in it. Why would they want pictures of me? But then you see pictures of like, hey, look, Mark Maron came to the movie. Why not have a couple of those pictures out there? Why is Mark Maron in here? He went to that thing, to the cool thing with the cool people. I dressed down a little bit, though, because I knew in my heart, like, this is not my night. So just wear a denim shirt. Why am I telling you this? It's so stupid, isn't it? Jeez, man. It was fun, though. So I walk the carpet, and I got an email from some woman. You know, we said, I yelled hi from the stands, from the grandstands where the people are, where they let some fans sit, and you just said hi in a very unenthusiastic way. And you should really appreciate your fans more. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? I was taking selfies with people. I was waving. I was saying hi to people. Like, you must have the one moment where probably what happened, you want to know what probably happened? Is I'm wandering around the red carpet area. And oddly, there's a lot of people that weren't in the movie wandering around the red carpet area. And I saw Jonathan Banks. Is it Banks or Bank? I think it's Banks, who plays Mike on Breaking Bad. And I just found out from a friend of mine who I grew up with in Albuquerque, New Mexico, that Mike is living in the building he lives in and they'd become friends. So I thought I'd say hi to Mike and, you know, maybe he knows who I am. And I said hi to Mike and I said, my friend Dave says you guys are pals in Albuquerque because that's where they shoot and he's got a place there. He goes, yeah, Dave's a good guy. And it was about 3 minutes into my conversation with Mike where I realized that he's not Mike. He's Jonathan. But where I realized, like, he's got no idea who I am. I'm just some guy on a red carpet. I've got nothing to do with anything. And so there was that great moment. But then Ed Begley hugged me. So made up for it, balanced it out. But anyways, my point is, maybe you caught me at that moment where I was sort of like, what am I doing here? Why should I even be here? Hi. Maybe that was that. Not like some weird dismissive attitude I have. Perhaps I was having one of my own insecure reflective moments. But I did get to see, I saw Ed Begley. I'll say it twice. He was very nice. And then I got into the theater and I said hi to a lot of fans, did a lot of selfie taking, was enjoying myself in my denim shirt, my new denim shirt that got sent to me from the Ship John guy. Bryan Cranston came up, gave me a little hug, congratulated me, said I was doing good. And I said, you're doing good too. And we had a moment. I felt like one of the people at the thing. But there's still part of me like, I don't know what I'm doing there. And I'm very excited to see celebrities. I saw Aaron Paul, and I was almost going to go wander up and just say hi to Aaron Paul. It's his night. He's the star of the movie. But I didn't want to risk another situation where, like, who's this guy on the carpet, you know? Maybe I'm projecting that. I don't know. My point is that I'm still excited by celebrity, and truly the most exciting moment for me, just because I watched all Breaking Bad recently. What's his name? Giancarlo Esposito. Is that his name? Yeah, he was there. I was excited to see him. I didn't go talk to him. He scares me a little. But I saw, like, I heard a voice I was familiar, and I turn around. It's Hank! Hank from Breaking Bad. I don't even know his name. I don't even know the actor's name. And I'm like, oh, fuck, there's Hank. I was so excited to see Hank, and he's talking just like Hank. I couldn't believe Hank was there. I didn't even know the guy's name. But I'm like, oh, shit, that's Hank. And I was happy. I still have those feelings. I didn't go to the party afterwards because I, you know, I what am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do? I saw Cranston. I saw Ed Begley. You know, I saw Jonathan. I was going to go to the party. Maybe he'd be there. I could explain to him who I am, not just some weirdo from New Mexico wandering around the carpet. But what am I going to do? Go feel awkward at a party? Come on. I got hugged by Ed Begley. What more can you ask for from a red carpet experience? And I saw Mike Chiklis briefly leaving. Come on. Oh, I saw Walter Hill there. I had a nice chat with Walter Hill, who's been on this show, the director. That was great. That was great. But Hank was there. I should find out what that guy's name is. Shouldn't I? Should I have done it before I did this? I'm a big fan of the guy that plays Hank. Hey, Jackie Tone is on the show today. And I saw the guy who plays Hank. And he talked just like Hank in real life. He sounded just like Hank did. But I guess I should bring up the movie. The movie, I was very happy to see those people again. It was sort of a, I would say it's almost a comedy, but it's engaging. And Aaron Paul's great. These are great characters. And he's in it. I saw Jesse Plemons, the guy who played the psychopath. He was there. I love him, man. He was in Black Mass. He's been a lot. He's great. And he's with Kirsten Dunst. Are they married? I guess they're married. We had a nice chat. He's in the movie. Jonathan Banks is in the movie. Cranston's in the movie and flashbacks. But the movie really picks up right where Breaking Bad ends. Oh, the guy who plays Skinny Pete. I met that guy. He's not like that in real life. I am still amazed. Skinny Pete doesn't act like Skinny Pete in real life. Badger's Matt Jones. Badger doesn't act like that either, but he acts closer to Badger than Skinny Pete acts to Skinny Pete. I am such a fan of this show, apparently. So anyways, what was I talking about? The movie starts where Breaking Bad ends, and it's basically Aaron Paul. It's Jesse's story. And it's great. It's great to revisit those characters. Vince Gilligan was there. I didn't say hi to him. He's been on the show. That was an important show that Bryan Cranston won, because I, for the fucking life of me, could not separate him from Walter White. I was so deep into the show, and I'm looking at Cranston, and I'm like, dude, I don't know who you think you are, but I need to talk to Walter White. So can we make that happen? I don't know what this story is about Malcolm in the Middle, but it seems out of character for you, Walter. I'm learning, but I still have a thing, right? Oh, I should have said hi to Hank. All right, look. Let's read this email real quick, because I think I owe people an apology. And it's weird because I thought about this when I said it. Subject line, kid haver. Mark, I love you and the show, but please, for God's sakes, can you stop with the whole world is going to hell and I'm so happy I don't have kids routine? I'm one of those kid haver type people who is fully simpatico with your very honest and realistic worldview, and thus I too have a serious sense of dread about climate change and the fate of the human race. My 8-year-old daughter is currently in our dining room earning some extra credit by watching a few climate change news clips, and it's breaking my fucking heart. She is still so innocent and has no idea how tough her life will be one day because of all this. We all do our various daily tap dance routines so that we can put one foot in front of the other and not let the weight of it all prevent us from going to work and living our lives. But hearing the no kid / end of the world thing just takes the wind right out of me. By all means, be happy you don't have kids. They can be a pain in the ass, and it's often a ton of menial and boring work. I mean, there isn't a parent alive who doesn't occasionally fantasize about being child-free. All I'm saying is that you often mention how you're worried about the children you didn't have, much less the children you could have had. I would request that you channel that feeling when you're about to go down this road. I think it will give you a sense of what the parents in your audience are thinking and feeling. Thanks for all you do. Love all the guitar dork talk. Please keep it up, Matt. All right, Matt. You're right. I realize that, and I'm not even going to be flip about it. I know it's hard. I know it's heartbreaking. I know it's you know, times are dire and scary and noted. And I feel the impulse to, you know, kind of slip one in, like sort of like, but, you know, I don't have kids. Yeah, I'm not going to do it, though, even though I just did it by couching it in the, like, I could have done it, and then I did it, but not in the same tone. You know how that works? Seriously, though, Matt, point well taken, and I did realize that after. It's like, you know, what am I doing that for? Why am I saying that stuff? There's people that are trying to deal, and I'm just sort of like, just me. It all ends with me, and I'll be out from under it before it goes bad. Okay, fine. But I don't have to, you know, make it worse for people. I understand. Look, Jackie Tone is here. I enjoy her. We have a connection that goes back centuries to Eastern Europe. Jews. Yes, this is Jew talk. There will be Jew talk. So if that's enough for you to go like, all right, I'm out, then go fuck yourself. Jew talk coming down the pike. Me and Jackie Tone. Part of being Jewish is saying you're a Jew and talking about Jew stuff. You can watch her in all 3 seasons of Glow. That's on Netflix. You can seek out her stand-up. And you can listen to us talk right now about her and Jews.
How do you roll with these, Mr.
Those
Barrett?
Were left there. Okay. I've had people smoke weed.
Oh, weed. In the
podcast. There's some people that someone must have brought that at some point.
Sure.
Like, I don't stop people from doing things. I've had people come with coolers of beer because they can't get through a fucking hour.
1 hour in the morning.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then a couple people smoke weed. Who is really? Just Kevin Smith, really.
Really, sure.
I think. Because he has to, I think. Can I have a Kleenex, please?
Do you think he actually has to? I could have handed you the box, but since we're friends, I handed you Individ.
Yeah. Do I think he actually has to?
Yeah.
Actually? No. But right. I mean, does he think he has to? Probably.
Sure.
Is it a deep ingrained habit? I don't know. You know, I haven't seen that guy in a long time. I have no idea how he's doing.
Right.
How are you doing? Are you all right?
Well.
Are you?
I mean, it comes and goes. I saw on Instagram yesterday a girl I didn't know posted a video of the last thing her mom said before she died, and I took a nosedive the rest of the day was over.
Why do people do that?
Why do people? Well.
You mean the actual footage of her dying?
Right before her mother was going, I love you, and I'm going to miss you. And I'm even getting choked up now, and I was like, and I just like went off it. And then my whole day, I was just like, oh my God, the last moments, this girl, it was a disaster. But I was having a great day
but,
yesterday.
But it was footage?
It was footage.
That's rough. I don't know why people.
Why did she do that?
I mean, is that a positive thing that we can do that stuff?
I
don't know.
What it was is she was like, listen, I'm grieving and I want to share my grief. And people were probably reaching out to her and going like, hey, we're here for you. We love you. This, you know, whatever, the improv community. Or I don't know.
Oh, you
this
know
girl.
The person?
No.
Oh, you didn't know her.
I was random that I ended up on her talk about addictions and all that. But like Instagram.
Are you really in? I'm trying to figure out how to do stories correctly. Like, I'm still a novice. Like, I've kind of...
I can teach you in 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think I've got it. I think I've departed Twitter for the most part.
I never really fucked with Twitter. I was always more of, like, an Instagram person, but I'm not on it that much.
Yeah.
Because I try not to be.
Yeah.
But then I also, you know, there's this weird thing. I was just working with Amy Heckerling.
Yeah, how do I know
she's
her?
Amazing.
She's a director.
Yeah. She was just saying that she was pitching all these actors for this new show she's doing.
Yeah.
And all the executives were just asking about their numbers and all like these people, the followers.
Instagram
followers.
Numbers.
And I talked to Betty about it because
she's off
it. But she took the other route, which is like, hey, I'm going to have none.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to deal with any of it.
And look at her Emmy nominated actress. With no followers.
No followers. But it's this weird thing of like every time I go like, I just want to leave it. I don't think that like my happiness lies in like I'll be on Instagram for 20 minutes. Then I'll just sort of look up and realize I'm on it. I don't remember opening the phone. I don't remember opening the app. I don't remember going in.
Yeah.
And now 30 minutes of my life has passed.
Yep.
And I've learned that a stranger's mom has passed away and a lot of people took pictures of their food.
Yeah. A lot of people took pictures of their food. And I feel the same way. But I find that
you're at a different level though. Like I think if you didn't have an Instagram, no one would give a fuck because you're Marin and we love you.
With me,
I'm like building, and apparently one of these very pertinent building blocks is an enormous Instagram following.
I guess so. I don't know if I'm like at some level where I don't need it. It seems that people enjoy it. I just have to figure out what exactly I'm doing on it because I don't think about it in terms of branding.
Right.
But I do like, it is an audience.
And I like, when I'm doing my stories and walking my dog and writing fake songs and doing this bullshit, I'm enjoying that. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when you're enjoying yourself, people are going to enjoy it and all that. But the like pressure to have to is when I start to like reject it because I'm like, I run this fucking ship.
Yeah,
but I don't want to have to.
Also, you don't want to be annoying because like you're already a little.
You're not kidding.
And like it's too much of you.
Yeah, but it's funny because coming from someone like you who's never annoying and always sort of kind and calm, it's weird that you would
take a shot at you.
Well, yeah. I was also wondering, if we would talk about the times we've gotten in fights today.
Well, sure. I mean,
I just thought it was.
But they were just like, it was just bitchy Jew fights.
Bitchy Jew fights.
But it wasn't like they're not real fights. It was, well, when I first met you, I think I was like, all right, this is what this is. And I know what this is. Uh-huh. I know this particular Long Island strain of Semitic neediness.
And then you looked in my eyes and saw a fucking mirror.
Did I? Well, a different kind of thing. A familiarity.
A familiarity. Because I feel like
emotionally
you
were probably somewhere. But you're definitely a different strand of
100%,
Jew.
100%. But I think when you...
I'm familiar with it and I have it in my family.
When things I do annoy you, I think it's because they're things you either do or want to do.
Or did.
Like when I got out of that elevator at Arclight and you shouted at me in front of all those people.
What did I do?
I feel like you did that because you were mad you couldn't get out of the elevator. I meant to talk to you about this. Am I right?
I'm trying to think which part. This obviously resonated more with you than me because it's not at the tip of my brain.
Well, you got a lot going on.
What happened at Arclight?
This doesn't come through my daily life, but when I'm sitting across from you and having this conversation, I'm like, oh, this is a thing. We were in an elevator, and I love this. I love you so much.
Arclight in Hollywood?
Yeah, we were doing
a thing?
Glow panel.
Right, sure.
And the elevator said Max, and I already, listen, you have my number. You know I'm Jewy and neurotic, and I'm not going to deny any of that. Uh-huh. I don't love an elevator. Yeah. I would have been happy to take the stairs of the fucking Arclight, but here we are in this elevator, and we're supposed to go up, and it goes down, and it says 6 people max,
right.
14 of us in there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't need to be.
Yeah.
I'm getting a little hot. I don't need to be in here.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to go up. It goes down, and then it does like a down up.
Yeah, yeah.
So when the doors open, I just go, I'm gonna get out. I'm gonna walk. And you go, you Jewish enough? She shouted out at me, but everyone, but I was feeling sensitive because I was scared.
Okay. And then, yeah.
And then downstairs you said, oh, you're being real sensitive today.
I felt bad. Couldn't take it.
I said, well, yeah, I was scared, but I didn't love that.
It's all very familiar to me, and I lock into it, but also I guess it is somewhat of a projection. I know what's going on. I know when the jokes are coming. I know when there's one scene in Glow where I was actually mad at you. Where I'm talking to the whole group of you, and you said something, and I said something back, and it was real. I was like, shut the fuck up. Enough with it. You know, it's just like it's the thing where it's sort of, I think I do have an impulse to do what you do, but I somehow stopped it a long time ago. It's like, oh, look, there's a little bit of open air with nothing being said. I'll take that opportunity.
I have an idea. Yeah. Well, it's because I'm so codependent.
Is it?
It's partly.
Are you?
Yeah.
Come on. You're the codependent one?
Well, I'm learning about it, but I think it's because I'm finding out now I had a boundaryless childhood.
Well, that's what I identify with.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I feel. And like, I guess I fight. Yeah, I guess maybe I'm a little more ahead of you in sort of knowing
age?
Things about myself. Yeah, age, sure.
Just shouting age.
Yeah, I had the boundaryless thing. I mean, that must be it. That's part of it. But you seem to like adulation and attention.
Sure.
And I pretend like I don't.
Right.
Because I need to fight for it. I need people to feel a little uncomfortable before they give me the attention.
We do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But
I know you're familiar to me only because I have family in where they grew up. I have Long Island people.
Sure.
You know, I come from, you know, my family's from Jersey, but there's the Long Island factor, faction. And then, you know, I grew up, like I went on a Barentine tour.
Mm-hmm.
So, like,
did you go to the improv?
I think we did, yes.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah,
all those years
now
later.
Now that I remember, we did go to the improv.
Because I've been doing shows at the improv so countless times, and I'm like, this is not appropriate for the 16-year-olds who are here.
So, did you go on a teen tour?
No, but I've performed at the improv.
That's right.
All my Jewish friends went on teen tours when I was a kid, but I moved here. I moved from New York to L.A. when I was just graduated from high school.
Well, let's go back then. So you grew up where? Which part of the island?
I grew up in Oceanside, Long Island.
Now, what part is that?
It's Nassau County, so it's the South Shore.
Right.
It's like by Freeport, Baldwin.
It's not Five Towny, though. It's not.
Five Towny is fancier and, believe it or not, Jewier.
What kind of town was that? Was it working class? It wasn't Jewish? Was it Catholic, Irish?
Yes, exactly.
Right.
It was all of that. So there was like a Jewish factor, and there was also like a big Puerto Rican and Dominican factor.
Oh, yeah?
And then, yeah. And then there were a lot of Italian kids and a lot of Irish kids.
Right. And you're the, how many kids in your family?
Three. Two big brothers, and then me.
What did they end up doing?
Unsurprisingly, I'm the baby.
Right. Are they still in New York?
Yeah.
Being
New
York-y?
One's in Jersey. Be so New York.
Like Bruce Springsteen fans?
No, like dead fans, Fish fans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Like maybe there's still mushrooms in their lives and they're like in their 40s.
Right.
And like, like maybe my brother.
Cargo shorts, sandals.
100%. And maybe the day after my brother's son was born, he like went and did mushrooms at Madison Square Garden.
Maybe.
Well, because it was Christmas Eve and like that's the big Fish show.
Yeah. Not anymore.
No.
That's over, isn't it?
I think so.
So those are, you're all kind of creative hippie kids.
Well, weirdly enough, my brother, like my big brother has like an eBay business. My middle brother's a personal trainer and I'm me. So my dad's a musician and a singer songwriter or was, but both my parents are phys ed teachers.
Mm-hmm. Really? In high schools?
They are both retired.
But your dad's dream was a musician thing?
Mm-hmm. My dad's dream was to be a musician, a singer songwriter. Playing piano and guitar and bass.
Do you play any of his songs?
No, I don't as much. Well, I don't really play like as much straightforward music anymore. It's more like my stand-up and musical comedy and that kind of thing. Or writing songs for lots of right turns. But I'm writing songs for a cartoon I'm doing for Amazon.
Oh, good. But all right, so this is like a pretty working class family.
You didn't
grow up like in, you know, Five Towny, Jappy.
No.
You're not like a Jap.
No.
You're just a kind of a meat and potatoes Jew.
The rare meat and potatoes Jew.
No, there's a lot of them, man.
It's like I never described a Jew as meat and potatoes.
Well, I mean,
it's
I
Irish.
I know. I mean, I could think of like we could change the food.
Sure. Yeah, but, more of like a sort of brisket and knish.
Sure.
Kind of Jew.
Yeah. but that was because it's definitely a different thing than the other ones. Right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
You knew when you were growing up that the class difference between Jews, you could feel
I
it,
knew
right?
that I was not the Jews that like went to sleepaway camp, but we went, but my parents worked there. The only way we could afford to go is my dad was like the head of the kitchen and my mom was
true?
Like the camp mom. Yep.
For how long? For a month?
For 2 months, for the whole summer. And we went our entire lives. Our entire lives. We were like sleepaway camp kids.
They had the gig every year?
They had the gig every year.
So you're like the regulars.
We were staff kids. We're called staff kids.
But when sometimes when the Jappy kids would come back, they'd be like, well, they're not really.
Right. And I knew that I wasn't with the kids who could afford to go there for $8,000 to $10,000 a summer.
Right. Like, but they and they knew
us.
You too.
Sure.
So were you the cool one? Were you
well,
letting
I
them
was
smoke and
cool.
stuff?
I was cool in that, like, I was always a weird kid and an actor and a theater kid. You don't say.
But you were playing guitar, too, at that time, right?
I didn't play guitar till I was 18.
Yeah.
So I was after camp, which was crazy. Right. But I was, like, I dressed in thrift, like, it was part need, part
right.
I was that weird kid.
Right,
and
yeah,
so
sure.
It wasn't like, I didn't want your fancy things.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I did.
Right.
But I low-key acted like I didn't and then was, like, a thrift shopper weird kid.
So all three of you went to the camps?
Mm-hmm.
Every summer?
The camps. Easy with the term, the camps.
Sorry, the camp.
Singular.
Where was it?
Upstate New York. Camp Lakonda.
Yeah, it was a totally Jew camp?
Jew camp.
And
for services on Friday night.
Really?
Adon Olam.
Hashem Olam. Not everyone does that version. It's weird. There are different versions of Adon Olam.
Oh.
You know there's a slow one that I grew up with?
Do I need it? What is it?
Adon Olam, Hashem Olam, Paterem Kol Yetzir Nivra. And I think maybe that picks up at the end and they switch it sometimes. Adon Olam.
Adon Olam, Hashem Olam.
Yeah.
Wow. I forgot I knew that one.
Yeah, this is a full-on middle-class conservative Jew-ness uh-huh. going on.
I love it. I haven't done... It's funny, though, because, I mean, I play so Jewish on GLOW, and I'm obviously very Jewy as a person, and I quite like that about myself, but I don't know any... I know very little about Judaism.
And that's the
and
same
I wish
of
I
all
knew
of us.
More.
We know that song.
That's right, but
I don't even know what it's saying.
I don't know what it's saying, and I don't know when the holidays are or what they
you
mean.
You
kind of
know. They're kind of around... I was born on Kol Nidre, so, like, I know that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are going to be around my birthday.
Right.
Like, it's soon. I didn't stop really drifting. I didn't start drifting from that till I was older. Like, I would find a place to go when I was in my 20s and stuff.
No, I think so, too.
You know, but now
anymore.
I don't. Yeah, it's sort of sad.
I think so, too, especially now that...
We just don't want to go home. You know, it's like, it starts like that, where you're like, do we need to go home for the Jewish holidays? That seems crazy.
Right.
Right? Like, Thanksgiving, maybe you'll go home for. But the Jewish holidays, you know? So
and
then
over Christmas, like, no one even goes home for Hanukkah. It's just like,
of course not.
Yeah.
But like you can find other Jews here. No one ever invites me to Seder's.
Really?
No.
I might. You won't come.
You do a Seder?
I don't do
it, but
No, I'm saying, like, I know people that do Seders, and I actually love it when someone goes, like, hey, come for this, come for Shabbat, or come for Seder. Like, I don't really do them, but it's always super nice.
I think that people are nervous to invite me, and I think that that's probably warranted, but I'm pretty good. Like, I get nervous, too. Like, if someone invites me, I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm just going to go over there. But then I go, and it's fine. It's nice.
Yeah,
I know how to be a guest.
Of course.
I don't freak out.
100% not.
I don't know. I talk about this a lot on the show about not being invited places, but you got to invite people to be invited, I think, is the thing. No?
I also think, yes, I do, but I also think that there's like a vibe about a person and you give off a vibe like you don't, not that, that you don't want to be invited.
Yeah.
Like you give off a vibe like, well, I don't need to do this. I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
But
well,
do want to, but I think, I personally, and maybe I'm reading you wrong, but I see past that and I don't think that of you.
No.
I don't think like, oh, he doesn't want to come places.
Yeah. See, I think that's our problem is maybe you see past it and then I have to go harder to keep you out of me.
True. Oh, that's so real. It took me a second for it to like really get into the folds.
You can't. I can't get her out of me.
She's in claws.
So, all right. So you're going to camp every summer with your parents.
And then I had to like be really sort of behave at camp because my parents were there. So like all the girls were like sneaking to other bunks and making out, and I couldn't do any of that because my parents were there. But cut to my parents didn't give a shit.
Like, you didn't make out at camp.
A little bit. I was so prude until I was like. 18 years old. I was so neurotic. I mean, not that I'm not anymore, but I was so neurotic as a kid.
Yeah.
I think it comes
making
from,
out at camp, you have to.
But I think it comes from the boundaryless nature of my childhood. Like,
well, what was that though? What do you, I mean, your parents were teachers. You just mean like, what form of boundarylessness?
I'll tell you. Like, I didn't have a curfew. Because everybody else had a curfew. So my mom was the cool mom that was like, what are you going to do? Stay out by yourself?
Right.
Your friends have a curfew. You're going to come back at some point.
Did she talk like that?
100% still does.
And here, so, listen to this one. I got this one. Do you want us to say no? That was crazy.
That's identical.
No.
Like, that's not a quote, but that's the subtext of what she's saying. What do you want me to do? I'll say no.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so then I become the adult.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And then I would have to choose. Also, if my brothers had sporting event stuff, she would go, what are you going to come to? You don't need to come to that.
Yeah.
And then we never had family dinners. We never had to sit around a table and look at each other and check in and be together. We never had to. And then when I had my performances, my brothers never came. There was never like a family unit vibe because my mom was like, the boys don't want to come to your singing. You don't want to come to their sports. Except you got to go support your brothers and you got to support your sister. Like, I love the idea of, I don't know, not making your kids, but everybody has family dinner. And so it just felt like a lot of floating. And in my mom's brain, she was being this cool mom. And in my brain, it was like, grasping for like,
you want some
who's
definition.
The adult?
Yeah. No, I get, I understand that one. Yeah, but I think my parents too were, needy people and self-involved people, right? So what I've determined is that they were not that capable of, sort of selfless kind of unconditional love stuff. They, you know, I was just sort of an extension of their worry. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
It wasn't, I don't, and my dad was never around. So like, we had family, we didn't really have family stuff because he was sort of not, you know, he was working. And my brother was at tennis school and tennis camp. We both took different paths. So I never really thought about the unity thing.
There was not, but what's funny that you say that about your dad is my dad asked me in my 20s or something. He was like, you know, sorry I wasn't around.
Where was he?
Were a kid, I'll tell you. And I that wasn't my experience of my memory of my dad. Because we played music together. So he'd sit at the piano and we'd sing and do harmony.
Yeah.
And anytime anyone came over, me and my dad had our little duo performance. And my mom and I always had like kind of a Stiller and Mira shtick. And we would do, it was always like, Jackie, go. And I didn't notice that I was sort of being put on display because I liked it and I think wanted it.
Yeah.
But my dad also had these trade shows. He's a postal historian, so he is a philatelist.
Wait a minute. So this guy's a singer-songwriter, the gym teacher, the camp operator, and now he's a philatelist?
That's right.
Which is a postal historian.
Yes. So he buys, he used to, he just sold
stamp
his business.
Stamp collector.
Buys and sells and trades. And so there was a time.
He sold the business? How much did he sell the business for?
He did okay.
Come on.
I think it was worth like $375.
Come on.
And he sold.
There's still people that do that?
Well, he didn't get that because each piece individually would have been worth that, but he sold it for, I don't want to talk.
Right. No, I'm just curious about that the interest is still there.
Over $100,000.
Sure. Okay, because they're actual things.
Yes.
The big books of little stamps with
40,
the little weird
50
little
years.
The little sticky thing that you stick it in the book with and the little wax envelopes.
But there were envelopes which are called covers, which depends on this is truly
full sheets of stamps.
But it's not only stamps. It's any postal history. So people collect things that randomly went through a post office.
Did he have one of those upside down plane stamps?
He did not. Mm. We would have been very rich if he did. That was the one stamp we all knew about.
The Grail. The one. I don't even know if it exists.
The Grail. It's fake.
Yeah.
Some guy made it up about 18 years ago. So he was doing these. He did 35 weekends a year and he worked all day every day during the week. Yes. He was literally never around. And I don't remember that. I remember like playing and singing.
Well, a good hour. Of connection.
That's true.
You know, we'll transcend, you know, a few
weeks
of absence.
Weeks of absence.
Sure,
yeah.
For sure. I mean, it's really about the connection, I think, ultimately. I think that's the one thing that saves any of it.
Yeah.
That, you know, I do feel connected to my parents. I don't, I don't think I'd rely on them for anything, but I do, you know, I know them.
I would have relied on them.
Yeah.
Like, in now I still do, but they got so much of their own shit.
Are they together?
And I'm having to constantly be like, did you go to that doctor? Or please, please don't eat that. And a friend of mine actually told me that I need to stop with fighting with my parents about what they eat.
What are they
eating?
Because
in the fucking garbage, rat poison.
Really?
They are. It's unbelievable.
Like, what'd you grow up with?
Well, my dad has had like a heart attack and a stroke and all, has diabetes. And he's like, yeah, I cheated tonight. I had a little bit of French, I had a sugar covered French toast with a side of bacon. I'm like, what? Wow, what are you doing?
Wow. Sugar.
But then he sometimes but I'm like, why are you telling me too? Like,
what,
you know,
diner?
I'm going to. Yeah, of course. Always at a diner, yeah. Or at Flakowitz.
What's Flakowitz?
It's the Jewish deli they eat at in Florida.
Oh, they're in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Flakowitz. Where the hell's, where does the, where in Florida?
Probably Lake Worth or Boynton Beach or Jewish town, USA.
But it's just weird. Like, you know, you always think like, who would end up in Florida? But then like, something happens to you as a Jew when you start visiting there, you get older and you're like, not bad.
It's kind of nice.
Well, there's a weight to it that it's actually relaxing. And I don't even know how that's possible given how densely populated it is and how fucking weird it is. But there's something about it where you're like, it just slows you down.
I couldn't agree more. And my parents are like staunch New Yorkers. They said they were never going to be those old Jews that went down to Florida.
Yeah,
not
but they're
us.
All that.
Yeah, like, not us. Forget it. We're never going.
Right.
And they're down there. They have more of a social life.
They're full of, staunch New Yorkers,
uh-huh,
who said they were never going to go to Florida. 100%. They're surrounded by them.
Uh-huh.
Because they're all their, everyone that's like them went there.
Like-minded Jews. They love it.
Oh, yeah. They just sit in circles and complain about what they did and what they didn't do and what they should do and how much it cost at that place.
That's right. The doctors.
The doctors and the two restaurants that everyone goes
to.
Do you go to that place? Is it still good?
Flakowitz, I do. Yep, delicious.
Flakowitz.
Bagel chips are delightful there.
Wolfie's used to be down where my mother's is gone.
Mm.
Why did I grow up like, I grew up, here's the thing, I grew up like envying people of your ilk. Like, to me, the Jewish sensibility was always comes from people like your, like the Long Island people, Brooklyn people, real New York people. I was from Jersey, but my parents moved away early on. So my idols, comedically, whether it was Woody Allen or Richard Lewis or Buddy Hackett, or there was a New York sensibility that I only had genetically from Jersey. So I had to sort of aspire to it.
It's so funny because it's so in you.
No,
like,
I know.
I think you felt like, I got to reach for that, but like, you are already it.
I mean, it's in me because like, Jersey's Jersey, but it's still like, but they were just my heroes, always the old Jews, right? And I did, in college, I did Don't Drink the Water, and I played, you know, the old Jewish guy, the father.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, you know, I of course I could play that. I don't know where it came from, but it's in me. I don't know how it's in me,
it's
but it
so-
is.
It's so good. It really is. It's in all of us. It's really.
Is it? You just turn it on?
So. Well, have a weird thing of like, when I met this, my friend's friend the other night, and I couldn't, it was like such an instant, it was not obvious, clearly not a romantic connection, but it was just such an instant fusing of like brains and like sternums even. It was just like, oh, I get this person. It was just like, I mean, it's just cultural. Like,
yeah, but it's
he's like a Studio City Jew. Like, he's...
It's an Ashkenazi trip, though. Like, you know, you get into the Sephardic or into more... Like, there's some Jews I don't... Like, I'm like, you're a Jew? How is that possible? Explain to me. I see Hasidim, and I'm you don't look like a Jew. No. If you take off the hat and the hair, I don't know what's going on.
It's 100%. It's a mystery. It is such a mystery. But those of us that are like these cultural ones, just culturally... Like,
Ashkenaz, Russian... Yeah. Polish.
I was going to say Eastern
German.
European, yep.
Yeah. Eastern European Jews, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the same Madonna alums.
You got to have the same Madonna
alums. But I've met Reform Jews, and I'm like, no. I don't know what's happening there. So there was a guitar at the synagogue, and I don't know.
Wow. You're telling me the Rebbe was a woman?
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
No, come on. Get out of here.
But it's true, right?
It is.
It's weird.
That's
so
good.
All right, so how does so you're playing songs with your dad and he's collecting stamps on weekends, your brother's doing sports, your mother and you and her, your mother have some sort of shtick you do. So when do you decide that you need all this attention that show business?
Birth.
What about your grandparents? Are they around?
No.
Were they?
Yes. It's funny that you brought that up. So I want to answer the question about when I wanted to go into show business,
we'll
but there's
there.
Two.
Yeah.
My grandparents, no, they're not around. My dad's dad died when.
No, but when you were a kid, were they there? Because they were, that was, my grandparents they were my real sort of connection to everything.
No.
To everything, to comedy, to everything. My mother's parents, when I grew up, I'd stay there a lot. Where I'd go. Mm. And my grandma Goldie, that was it. She was it.
Oh, Jack and Goldie. Why is Goldie the best name? Jack and Goldie is the two best names I've ever heard.
Yeah, Jacob and Goldie. Yeah.
Oh, forget it. Jack. I have to name my kids Jack and Goldie now. Don't be weirded out.
No, I won't.
All right,
so go ahead.
Also, they're frozen in somewhere in Encino, my kids. So now I've always called them Darby and Michael, my eggs, but now I'm going to call them Jack and Goldie.
You sold your eggs?
No, they're frozen for me.
Okay.
Yeah, but now they were always Darby and Michael because those were the first names I thought of when I froze them. I said, be gentle with Darby and Michael when they took them away. Now they're going to be Jack and Goldie. It's too cute.
Why does one freeze their eggs? Explain it to me.
I froze my eggs because I was in a relationship when I was like 32, and I realized that I had done the exact same thing four times in a row, which was date a really awesome, charismatic comedian with a Peter Pan complex who was never going to make me a wife and give me children.
Right.
And as this relationship was ending, I was like, I need to work on myself, but I also definitely want kids and I want a career.
Mm.
And I have not a lot of examples of women who can do both. I think it's really challenging. And so I just decided right before that relationship ended that I was going to freeze my eggs, and I just went and did it.
So then they become plantable?
Yeah, you can plant those in the ground. You can have a baby tree. It would be pretty.
Okay, but that's the idea. You find
Well, yeah, then once you get, ultimately, I still am of an age where I can have children naturally, but I want to continue my career. I want to write and produce and do all my things and be in front of the camera. And it's fucking challenging. I heard Betty on here talking, too, like about women, you know, having an expiration date. And I think since I was never an ingenue, it's less of a deal breaker for me. Like, I'll just grow up and be a craggy character actress.
Yeah, but if
that'll
you get into
fun.
Production, it's like anything. Like, you know, it's really just relative to, you know, a very specific kind of like being in front of the camera trip in a certain way.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
But even like with, you know.
I don't want to trivialize it. It's hard for women on all levels, but you know what I mean?
Well,
but that part.
But I also want to be able to, even if it's not about what I look like, I want to be able to take the time to raise the kid.
Do you?
And I do. Mm. And I don't want to, after he or she is born, 4 weeks later, just be back either producing, direct, whatever the thing is. I want to be able to take that time. And right now, I can't realistically take 9 months to be pregnant and then another year to be with this child to make sure they feel nurtured and that I didn't just pop them out and hand them up to a nanny.
Right.
And I don't have those 2 years right now while I'm on this like sort of run of my career at whatever level this is, you know.
Sure.
I wanted to be successful as an actor or as a person in this business.
Yeah.
I started when I was 9.
Right.
And I got GLOW when I was 35.
It's a long
fucking haul. And now I'm like in these prime baby making years, actually the end of the baby making years, and in this like, oh, cool, making a show on here and there and working on all these.
No time for babies, no man either in the life.
I do. I have a boyfriend. I have a boyfriend. We've been dating for like 6 months.
But this is not one of the four. Comedian,
no,
Peter
that,
Pan complex. What is that? That means stay young forever? What's Peter Pan?
Yeah, I think it's this like, and the dudes that we can talk more specifically.
I was too neurotic and selfish to think about children. And it wasn't, I never thought I was going to stay young.
Well, what's crazy is it's not too late for you.
And that's what people say, but it kind of is. Would you want that in my life?
But it, well, that's a choice.
Fucking
but for me,
I'm watching my cats. It's slowly declining. I can't even handle it. You think I can't handle the heartbreak of just a kid coming home from school, not, you know,
needing you anymore?
Yeah, but just something that doesn't work out. Like, it's like my boundaries are so shitty emotionally that I just can't, I couldn't, I don't, I find that I couldn't handle, like, I think that was another, that was a problem with my mother too, is that my pain, even the most mundane, where she could have just said, this happens. It was sort of like, oh, that's terrible, like immediately commiserating.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the opposite, which was like, you'll be fine.
No.
Diving into the pain with you.
Right.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating.
And I think I have that. Like, it just like, you know, how do you, she didn't have any way of making me feel better other than trying to experience the sadness and then just resigning to that.
So
it becomes really her
thing.
Whatever. So that's, that I don't know why I started talking about that. That's why I don't have kids, and I don't regret it, and I don't really think about it that much. I just really am too neurotically full
wired
of panic. It just worried. Mm-hmm. I know it doesn't seem like I am, but
it totally doesn't. Worrying. You're really fooling everyone. I had no idea you felt that way. I
usually just make it anger. I don't. Uh-huh. That's the public face of my panic and
we
dread.
We have the anger in common too, friend. I don't love that about myself.
Well,
that's for sure.
Let's
okay,
go
back
real quick. We were at your grandfather, so your father's father was not around. Like
he died. He had a heart attack when my dad was like 19.
Oh,
fucking
and
nightmare.
So you didn't know any of your grandparents?
I didn't know. I knew my mom's parents are Holocaust survivors. Were they're no longer, but they survived the Holocaust. They moved after in the early 40s to Paris.
Yeah,
and then it's fucking crazy. And then.
Camp survivors. They got out.
Not camp survivors. The rest of my grandma's family was in various camps. And my grandma and my grandpa were miraculously like just one step ahead. And there's just, you know, all these miracles.
They knew when to get out.
They didn't know, but I guess, you know, they knew that the occupation was coming and other people knew too. But, you know, it's hard to think that that's going to be real. You go
We're living in it.
I didn't want to say that. We're living in it. And
which is sort of like, you know, how bad is this going to get really? You know,
and
like
how
you know,
people don't think it's real. And they're just like, they think that it's fake photos at the border and it's not real. And those people aren't real. Like what? That's staged?
No,
that's
I don't.
Staged by the left? I don't.
Oh, those people. Yeah. But I mean, I think people know
there's
it's
people
real,
in
but
my
there's
family.
So people, so everything moves so quickly now. There's not, people don't latch on to it for a long enough period of time.
That's exactly right. But like another mass shooting, and then day it's
once,
like...
When random acts of violence become defined by a certain ideology, you know, it's not so random anymore.
Mm-mm.
It doesn't mean that, you know, it's a... You know, but it's coming from an ideological place that is shared by many people. So when does that become a bigger problem?
That we all have fear. But because it's so common, the bigger problem is also this like weird gray wash over the whole scene. And you don't even see it because it's so prevalent. You're just doing your everyday life. And that bigger fucking cloud is just there again.
Well, now it's an actual cloud. It's actual fire. It's actual, like, you know, weather that's, you know, beyond anything we can handle. And, you know, we're starting to see that stuff. So it's sort of a race between ideology and the actual end of the environment.
End of the actual world. Yeah, that's right. And it's a blaze.
Yeah.
So my mom's
parents.
So
you knew them.
I knew them. But my grandpa only till I was like 10, and he didn't hardly spoke any English and chain smoked cigarettes, and he just sort of was
great.
Around.
Yeah.
But they were in Florida, and we were in New York.
Right.
And then my grandma, my mom's mom, I was closer with, but also they were so far away.
Right. Yeah, I think mine were too, but I think it's nice to have that connection with your grandparents if it's there.
Absolutely.
You know,
but they didn't really tell us, you know, stories. Obviously, right. I was a kid and they're not going to be like, listen to these atrocities.
But you knew they had these grandparents
mm-hmm.
and they'd been, you know, just to look at them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's enough.
I agree. And they were around and I had great conversations with my grandma. And in high school, I filmed her and asked her questions about World War II. And,
oh, really?
Which was crazy because then when we got to shoot that campfire scene.
In Glow. Yeah.
It was nuts. Liz and Carly had some, you know, aunt, whatever. They had Sarah. And I asked if I could change it to the name of my mom's Aunt Pessel, who was my grandma's only sister that stayed in Poland with her parents.
Uh-huh.
And they all got, I will say, exterminated, because that's what happened. And I always choke on that word. Like, do I need to be dramatic? And it's like, it is fucking dramatic. That's what happened.
Right.
And so they let me change the name of that story I was telling to Pessel, and I memorialized my great aunt. It was...
That's great.
Just who... Boy, that's a nuts thing.
Yeah,
who gets
yeah.
to do that?
It's beautiful.
Glow is cool.
Definitely cool. All right, so nine... When does the show business start?
Well, when I was about... 10 years old. I also...
Because I know you're like, you're almost a child actress.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Well, I was like, did a couple episodes of The Nanny when I was like,
how does
12.
That happen?
My mom had a friend who I think she took Lamaze with when she was pregnant with my brother. And this woman was an agent and she worked out of her back house in Baldwin, Long Island. Her name was Aggie Gold of Fresh Faces Agency.
Yeah.
And she was a bolvan. This woman would call anyone and everyone, and she would say things like, my client is a star. You have to meet her. And if you don't like her, I promise you, I know you don't know her from a hole in the wall and she's never worked, but if you meet her and you don't like her, you're never going to hear from me again.
Yeah.
And then pitch. I would tell, I told my shrink that, and she goes, oh my God, she felt so awfully for me.
Yeah.
She's like, the little child in you, knowing those stories, your whole life you've been telling this as this positive story.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
But the amount of pressure that was on your shoulders to deliver that day when your agent was like, you'll never hear from me again if you don't think this person who I'm telling you is a star is
but
a star.
But did you know she was saying that when you were a kid?
I think so.
Oh.
Yeah, I think so. But I
don't know. Kids can absorb that shit.
That's how I felt. And,
you know, it's like
and instead, I delivered.
Yeah.
Instead, I was like, do I have a joke for you?
Yeah.
So I was writing stand-up when I was a teenager.
Is that true?
Yes. I don't know how funny it was, but yeah.
But you didn't do stand-up as a teenager.
I did a little. Like, I would go into Nickelodeon and do, like, 5 minutes of, like, impressions and jokes about an Easy Bake Oven and my boyfriend in elementary school and this
but
shit.
But you like shtick.
It was shtick.
How did you how'd you earn that shtick?
That's mom.
But who were her people? Was it natural or
because
you sort of have this timeless Jewish thing that that I always recognize and I always feel and I think it's, you know, at the core of all of us, but it's like, you know, it's almost like Fanny Bryce or
Tony
Fields. Yeah, and then to Joan Rivers. Yeah.
It was Fanny Bryce. But it's like my idols growing up were Gilda Radner, Joan Rivers, and Bette Midler.
Right.
Like when I saw them, I just saw myself.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm giving myself too much credit, but I just would go like,
no, that's how you do it. Yeah.
That's what I want. That's who I am.
Yeah.
I want to sing and I want to tell jokes and I want to be dramatic and I want to host stuff and I want to do Fashion Police and I want to be Bette Midler's Broadway show.
Yeah.
These are the things.
But it's interesting. You never thought to do stand up as a younger person because there was a couple of people that like teenage stand up phenomenons. One of them I think turned out to be in her 20s and lying.
Amazing.
I forget her name. It was kind of a controversy.
I want to look it up.
Like she was like a teenage stand-up comedian.
She
wasn't that good.
Oh.
But the angle was that she was a kid. But then turns out she wasn't really a kid.
There was that story, too.
And she kept doing it.
The woman that created Felicity.
Yeah.
She said she was like 22 and she was like 35 or something. I mean, I get if you're blatantly lying, that's not okay. But also, this business is this like, you have to be young and you have to be this. And it's like, that's why people are lying and saying they're younger. I don't say I don't lie about my age, but I wouldn't say I'm younger because I give a fuck. I say I'm younger because you give a fuck.
Yeah.
Because like people hiring actors.
Yeah.
They don't, if you look 29, but you're 39, you want the people to think you're 29 because that weirds their brain out for some reason, even though we're actors and that's the point.
Yeah. I don't like, I played a guy recently that was supposed to be, it was based on him. So there's no way you're going to make me 28.
Right.
But the real guy was like in his 20s and, you know, they cast me and it'd be a guy in his 40s and what? I don't give a fuck.
Right.
Put the wig on me. What are you going to do?
Who gives a fuck? Yeah. Make
the right,
little
so
gray.
You're nine. You're working with Fran Drescher.
Like, well, it was 11 or 12 when that was my first job that I got. And I just wanted to act. And my mom knew this agent like on Long Island.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's close to New York, but it's not like we were going and meeting agents. It all just sort of happened in a really lucky way. And I wasn't pushed into it by my mom. I begged and begged until finally when I was like 10 or 11, she was like, okay, we'll go. And so we met with Aggie.
The Long Island medium.
Yeah, the Long Island agent.
Yeah.
And it just happened. And I started going on auditions pretty immediately. And that was in like probably middle school
in
or late
city?
Elementary school. Uh-huh. So my mom
would schlep you in on the train?
Schlep me in on the Long Island Railroad and schlep me around. And ultimately, it was cool. You know, it was a lot because I would have to miss school and make stuff up. And I wasn't being obviously homeschooled like a lot of kid actors were. But I wasn't working that much at that time. I was just going on a lot of auditions and getting commercials.
But
and
were
stuff.
They weren't at, teaching at the school you were going to, either of them? They weren't at the...
No.
Oh, okay.
My mom was actually teaching at a yeshiva, but then she didn't have to, but she chose to stop when things started picking up with me.
Yeah.
Because I was coming to LA for development deals and stuff and doing.
For pilot season?
Yeah, and doing.
What happened? So you got the nanny was the first job?
Yeah.
And then you guys decided to move to LA?
Not. So I sent in a tape for the nanny and then I found out I got it, came out to LA, shot it. It was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
And then finished out high school.
Did you meet Fran?
I did meet Fran.
Did you do scenes with her?
I did. All my scenes were with her. Yeah, she was amazing. And actually, I played two different characters on The Nanny.
You guys must have really hit it off.
They
wanted, you're like a miniature Drescher.
I know. They wanted a mini Fran.
Yeah.
And I was, I mean, I don't know that that many 12-year-olds were running around being like, nah, whatever
yeah, yeah.
the shit.
Yeah.
And so when I was 12, I did one. And then when I was 15, I did another one and played a different character because they needed a mini Fran again. And they were like, yeah, fuck it. Just hire
the accent.
Hire the girl that already did it.
Yeah. So, okay. So you do that. You come back and you're like, I want to go to L.A., Mom.
And kind of, but I didn't even really know that I wanted
to go
to
out there
LA.
Once a year for the pilot stuff. And did you do more?
It wasn't even once a year. It was like when things would come up. If there was an opportunity, I'd go to L.A. If I got a commercial.
And
like,
your mother would go with you?
My mom would go with me. My mom would go with me. So then when it really happened, so most of the stuff was in New York. Like I did an episode of The Sopranos and I was just
Which
doing
one?
Like random. Season one where the soccer coach is fucking with the girls.
Oh.
It was like the one episode Tony didn't kill the person.
Oh, I'm trying to remember. I just watched them all.
I played Silvio Dante's daughter, Heather Dante.
Oh, okay.
But what's crazy is I did one episode.
Yeah.
And then...
Silvio as Will Steven?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then David Chase, the creator of the show, his daughter dropped out of college.
Yeah.
And then my character disappeared, and my name was Heather. And then this new... Meadow had a new best friend named Hunter. It was like a sort of a seamless, like, there were two Darrens. Like, it just was this random thing that was a Bewitched moment.
So and Chase's then I kid just, did it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Oh, wow.
Damn it. Yeah, I know. But that was that. But that was, again, like, I had so many of these. Like, I was supposed to be this recurring character that was just going to be on The Sopranos.
Yeah.
And be little Steven's daughter.
Didn't
and
happen.
Then it just, I mean, it happened once and then it didn't happen again.
You a Bruce Springsteen fan?
I'm not.
Yeah.
I mean, I like what I know of Bruce Springsteen, I like, but I'm not like a following crazy
fan. Well, who are you?
What,
were you like, who are you people?
Growing up, I loved James Taylor and Paul Simon and Joni Mitchell. I was into like that singer, songwriter.
I had a dream about
Paul Simon. I would lose my mind with
how
Paul
you,
Simon.
I have to teach myself how to finger pick properly. I've been fighting that forever.
You got
to
do it. I mean, I'm not a great finger picker. I have like my two or three patterns I do.
Right.
And I do them.
Right.
And I sound and I can trick you. But if you go like, play this song in this pattern, it's not like I just can.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah. I got it.
James Taylor, though, is ridiculous guitar player.
He is. Yeah. When did you?
Oh, Billy Joel.
Oh, you're a Billy Joel person. Okay. So
I'm
that's
in
it.
A Billy Joel
no, that's
person.
It. See, that's Jersey Springsteen, Long Island, Billy Joel. Okay. That's it.
That's it.
Okay. You're going back and forth to L.A. Then when does the commitment come? When does the music start happening? Because, like, you're not – when does the comedy start happening? You're doing bit pieces as a teenager on these shows as the Long Island girl or whatever, but then you kind of come into this musical comedy trip.
True. I was doing all this acting stuff, and then when I graduated from high school, I went to the University of Delaware for one semester.
Yeah.
But Delaware is set up in a weird way where – like
the school, you mean?
Yeah. Well, how they do semesters.
Yeah.
So mid-December, like December 10th or something, they go on break till like February 10th.
Yeah.
So there's a mini mester in there, and me and my mom and my agent Aggie Gold came out to L.A. I met this showrunner, TV creator, Danny Jacobson, who created Mad About You and used to showrun Roseanne, Macher, big show guy.
Yeah.
And he was like, let's make a show.
Yeah.
And I dropped out of college. And I said, let's make a show, Danny Jacobson. 20th to sign me to a development deal.
They did?
This is in 1998.
How old were you?
18.
18, so you got a development deal.
You got a development deal.
$250,000?
No, 120, 125.
Nice, all right.
Yeah. And I love you. And so that was, I was a teenager. I'd never obviously seen this kind of money. Who had? And I got this deal and I dropped out of college and I was like, let's go. And then we never even made a pilot. Like there was a script that maybe got,
who wrote
messengered
it?
Danny.
Yeah.
There was a script that maybe got messengered back to my hotel once or twice. And then I was like, I'm not in college. I'm not making this show. Then I went to the TV Guide Awards with my friend Ben, who was on The Nanny.
Yeah.
And I met Jessica Biel.
Yeah.
And we she's so fucking pretty.
Right.
We became instantly friends. It was like we had known each other forever.
Are you the same age?
She's a year younger than me.
Yeah.
And I was 18. She was 17. And it was like we were the friend we'd always looked for.
Yeah.
And I was going to go back to Delaware. This was still all on that break. The development deal, Jess Biel, the whole thing.
It crapped out all on that break or you waited for that?
Like it didn't crap out on that break.
Right, right, right.
That it was enough for me to be like, well, I'm not going to go back to school. I got this deal. I got all this stuff going on. And Jess, I was like, well, I don't have anywhere to live. I don't have a car. She's like, well, come live with me.
Huh.
So I moved in with her and her family in Calabasas while she was on Seventh Heaven.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, goodbye, Delaware. Hello, Development Deal and Celebrity Life.
Yeah.
And then nothing happened for however many years. So
that Development Deal, it made it to script, but you didn't shoot nothing. Right. And that was over
but
after a year.
But then they re-upped it for another. Yeah.
Gave you another year on the same deal or wrote another thing?
Same deal. He's like, we're going to make this show.
Yeah.
And then we never made the show. So the first 2 years I lived in L.A., I had money and I'm living at Beale's house. And I just was like, but I couldn't.
Are you guys still friends?
Yes. I mean, we're not as close as we were years ago, but.
She's got a whole life and kids and everything.
She does.
Yeah.
And so.
Oh, so this is one of those stories where you immediately feel the rush and the weird sort of leveling off of like, oh, this is how show business works. It doesn't just happen. You get, you know, this is it.
What's crazy is that this was my third deal.
From
this Danny Jacobson deal was my third deal.
Oh, so where were the other ones?
I was 15 and I got one at Warner Brothers with Nell Scovell, who created, I mean,
I know she's, Nell. So, I've interviewed her. Yeah.
I did my shtick, my 15-year-old stand-up shtick. Yeah. They said there was a breakdown that came out that said, we're looking for funny teenage girls.
Yeah.
I came in. I did my shtick.
Yeah.
She signed me to a Development Deal at Warner Brothers. I came out. I shot this pilot with Alan Thicke and all these rad people. I was 15 years old. We shot the pilot, and it was called Prudy and Judy, and it was me.
Oh, so that's really when that all happened.
So that was like, I'm a, you know, whoa, yeah. And a live studio audience, yeah. And I'm the star of this show, and I'm in the auditions. I'm 15 years old in the auditions with the other girls. Yeah. They're reading against me to see if their chemistry works with me. I mean,
So you're almost a child star.
Yes.
You're very close to being a child star.
And then a couple years later, I got the same deal at Nickelodeon when I was like 16. So that was, I think, 14, 15. Then at 16, 17, I got this Nickelodeon deal. Same thing. They were doing a spinoff of the kids' sketch show and now all that.
Yeah.
All that. So then I had a show called And Now This. All that and now this.
It
was going to be the second half hour. Rosie O'Donnell was hosting. We had this whole thing going. We made the pilot. They aired it. Canned it. They were like, we don't need two kids sketch shows.
So you've already taken two hits. Like, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my very first gig was a Rice Krispies commercial that I was so excited to book. My first big national commercial when I was 12. And then I see it on TV. I come running home from school because I hear it's on the air. And I come running. I'm not in the fucking thing.
Uh-huh.
I shot it. I'm in a leather jacket, Dice Claying out, eating Rice Krispies, and I'm just not in the commercial. So this had been going on for, you know, 10 years.
So by the time the Jacobson deals went south, the difference was that you still had a life at home, you know, and parents and like school and stuff.
Yeah.
But now you've moved out here on the deal and you're 20,
and it
happened again.
That's right.
Three strikes, you're out.
That's right.
And then
you don't even want to hear the fourth strike.
What?
The fourth strike makes me still cry.
What happened?
I book a series when I'm 23 called Regular
Joe.
Are you
still living with Beale?
No. Beale, I got my own apartment at this point.
Okay, yeah. Was that awkward? Can you leave?
I asked her if she could head out. I said, I'm going to stay with your parents in Calabasas, but can you sort of take it on the arches, honey?
Yeah.
Cute ass, by the way. Yeah. And then I smacked it. So when I'm 23, I go... It's so weird. This still makes me emotional. But I'm 23, and there's a pilot called Regular Joe, written by David Litt, who created King of Queens.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, he loves Leah Remini. He's going to love me. Let's go. I'm in a little box. I get it.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
And so I go and I meet on this thing. I book. So they tell me they're recasting the entire pilot. They're firing the girl that played the daughter, and they're looking for someone else. And it's being picked up to series, but they're replacing the daughter. And I book the series.
This is
mid-season replacement. Mm. This is not a pilot now.
Yep.
This is my chance to be on TV on ABC at 8:30. This is, by the way, the height of fucking TV.
Right.
People can't imagine that 8:30 on ABC really means anything anymore. But at this time, this was like, all there was network television.
Yeah.
HBO was like, whatever. And so I book this series, and it's the biggest thing that's ever happened to me. We're about to shoot the pilot. My parents come out. They fly in from New York, and they asked me to come meet with the producers at CBS Radford. I'm like, oh, okay, sure. Forget my parents in the car. I'm going to show them my dressing room.
Yeah.
I've taped everything up. I got a rug. I got candles. I got the whole thing. I pull up to my dressing room to drop my parents off before I drive over to the production office. On my life, Mark, a man is paint rolling my name off my parking space.
Nah.
100% true. And I'm getting choked up. And then I go and I'm like, what? Maybe they've just moved my dressing room. I don't put two and two together. I go to production. And the reason they've called me there is to fire me. So my parents watched, my parents, my mother, who gave up her life so I could be an actress, is watching a man paint roll my name off my parking space.
Oh, boy.
I wouldn't, it's such a fake, it's the fakest story I've ever heard.
Right.
Except that it happened to me.
Why did, what was the reason?
They were the studio and the network were 50-50 split on wanting to fire the girl in the first place, and they brought her back.
Fuck.
Yep.
So then what'd you do?
I was so depressed for so long. I was dating a musician at the time, and I poured my life into his life.
Uh-huh.
Do you know that Jason Mraz guy?
Uh-uh.
Mm, he's a musician guy. I was dating him, and my life became his life when I got fired.
But when do you start to take things into your own hands?
Not till my 30s.
Really?
Isn't that fucking crazy?
So you're 23 when that happened?
Yeah, 23, 24.
And what the next...
And I had just been fired and or had these huge highs that then became these monstrous lows.
But you're not performing on your own yet.
Well, I did stand up as a teenager. Like, I wasn't doing it. I wasn't pounding the pavement every night like, you know, you were.
Right.
But because my mom would have to take me. I was a child. Like, I wasn't pounding the pavement as a stand-up.
How old were you?
I was young. The few times I did Caroline's and the few times I did The Cellar...
What, like on mics?
Not even mics. It was like either shows where my agent would set it up or people knew that this younger person was coming.
Right. So why did that, when I brought up teenage comedy, you say you didn't do it?
Because I don't like to say that I was this person that was like...
Trying to be a comic, right.
I was a little bit, but it was a means, at that time it was a means to an end of like, I loved jokes, I loved shtick, and I was more doing comedy in rooms to get development deals, like in meetings.
Oh, right.
I wasn't like, out.
You weren't performing.
Yeah, I wasn't out every night,
right.
But I was occasionally. And like,
right.
When I got up there, I had bits and I had shtick and I did it.
No guitar, just straight.
No guitar, just stand up.
Yeah.
I didn't learn to play guitar till I was 20. You know that actor Brad Renfro? He's no longer. He overdosed on heroin.
Yeah.
He taught me to play guitar.
How'd you know him?
We did a movie called Deuces Wild, and it was a Scorsese produced, and everybody said it was a Scorsese movie, but it wasn't. And I was singing, and he was playing guitar, and he was like, you should play guitar. And it just, I mean, not that it hadn't occurred to me. I just was like, okay, and he handed me a guitar and taught me a bunch of blues chords.
There you go. That's all you need, three chords.
At that time, that was all I needed.
Okay, so all this is now in place, and you've failed many times, and you're just like being a codependent musician girlfriend.
I mean, I just can think of a time where he was on his music video and needed a bite of a sandwich and just came over to me and neither of us spoke.
Yeah.
And I just unwrapped the sandwich and put it in his mouth with my hand. And then he took a bite and turned around and walked away and went back to the set. That was what I'd become at 25.
Wow. So you're
24.
So your confidence is all shattered. Your sense of self is all garbage.
But I wasn't cognizant of that because he, in his mind, like I was still funny and fun and route. Like I wasn't walking around like, kicking a can, but I wasn't asserting myself and I wasn't trying to do comedy and I was still an actress. I was still going on auditions and trying to do things.
Yeah, right.
But I wasn't making stuff. I wasn't writing. I wasn't.
Yeah.
I mean, that sort of came. I got really back into stand up when, like, in my early 30s, I was like.
So for 5 years, you're just going out, doing.
Waiting for
that.
The phone to ring and being bitter that. And not being happy for my friends. Like that we're working and
like
low key.
You got all these shots and they didn't go.
And just being like, you know, my friend being on something and then everyone celebrating them and then me, you know, quote, having plans that night and not going in. And a friend of mine actually called me out in probably one of the most dramatic turns my life has ever taken. One of my best friends called me out, like in my, probably this was what changed my life ultimately was. I was trying to be a musician at, like when I was 28 or something, and I made this record and it cost me so much fucking money and I had no, like I
under
had some
your
money.
Name?
Yep. And I put this album
a
out.
Comedy record?
Nope. Just music. Cause I also have this other career as a songwriter. Like I was signed to BMG and I was a published songwriter and I wrote for like.
When was this?
Catherine McPhee and Christina Aguilera and stuff. The late.
How old are you?
At the time, like 30.
Oh, so this sort of happened after the musician boyfriend stuff.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then I was like, I did American Idol when I was something, 27. So then I was like being a songwriter and being a musician and
so
taking a break
the,
from
that
acting
that was
a
the
little
change,
bit.
Right? So like, so after the acting thing and the musician boyfriend, you started to write songs and perform songs in your late 20s. And then you were on American Idol and you were writing songs. You thought like songwriting seemed like a good racket to get into.
It was the worst racket to get into.
What if you deliver one, though? If you wrote a song
you're
for
not kidding.
Christina
but I
Aguilera.
Wasn't. So what ended up happening was that I was like realizing that I was spending all of my time and energy trying to writing these songs in hopes that somebody would like one. And it just didn't, it was so not fulfilling.
How'd your friend call you out?
Oh, well, she made a record of sad piano songs in her closet. And it cost her $0. And every single one of the songs.
Yeah.
Got on Grey's Anatomy, got in movies, got everywhere. And I remember we were all at a party once and everyone was hugging her and congratulating her in some huge movie. Her delicious, beautiful little piano song was in this monster fucking movie.
Yeah.
And everyone was freaking out and I think she'd invited me to come see it and I didn't respond. Something gnarly.
Right.
And then she said, you know, and I was like, and everyone was talking about seeing it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I haven't seen it yet. You know, then she just sent me an email like a couple days later and was like, hey man, I don't know how to say this without sounding crazy, but I don't know what to even, how to proceed here with this friendship because I can feel how not happy you are for me.
Yeah.
And it's repugnant.
Yeah.
I'm having trouble being around you when I know that what you feel toward me, when all I feel toward you is love. Like when you were on American Idol, I did a grassroots campaign for us all to change our names on Facebook to your name, just so your name would be everywhere. All I've ever done is support. Oh, I cry again. Yeah. All I've ever done is support you and love you. And you casually can't watch the fucking episode of Grey's Anatomy where I have one thing going on. And I was so disgusted with myself. And I didn't even, I wasn't cognizant of that I was even doing it.
Yeah.
And my heart's pounding. And I just was like, oh God, what happened to me? And I like said, I'm coming to your house right now. Please. Open the door. And she opened the door and it was like a hug fest and cry fest. And she was like, I can't believe that you were this responsive to this. I thought you were just going to say, that's not true. Fuck you. I am happy for you. You just can't tell, but you're showing up right now. And that's what I kind of wanted you to do. And we fixed it. But I was like a rotting, shitty version. I've been trying to do the fucking thing for 20 years.
Yeah.
I couldn't get any traction.
Yeah, I know that.
And I know you do. And I couldn't, and I just couldn't fucking enjoy other people's success.
Yeah, because you so hated yourself.
I fucking hated myself.
Yeah.
And I was so disappointed in myself.
You can't get out of it though when you're in it. And you try to be polite, you know, and it's like, I don't know. Well, it's good that you were able to.
Well, I was baby shaken out of it. It was like, unless...
Oh, I know, but that friendship meant enough to you to do that. You know, like if you didn't have that, like if you didn't have people that loved you or that people that, you know, you trusted and loved, I mean, you could have stayed there.
I would have I mean, I don't know how else I would have gotten out because I couldn't see myself.
Yeah.
Because what's tricky about being a comic or being us is that when we're in this fucking craggy state, it's funny. And people still... I know, but I mean that like... People still like you, and it's not like I was walking around and everyone was like, well, she turned into a real cunt.
Right.
It was just when I would like fucking stab someone really slightly or just act out in a way that like was really showing my true cards as opposed to being a loving human with an open heart, which is what I want to be instead of like an angry, craggy, you know, there's not enough space for everyone.
Bitter. Yeah. Yeah. And you,
bitter,
and you,
bitter
and
is the word.
Right. And then you resign yourself to it and you think there's a truth to it. And, you know, I guess you can make that funny. I mean, there's an intensity to it, but it's not. You know.
I don't even mean to make it funny. I just mean like inherently you're funny. I'm funny. So it's like when you're doing the thing that's
I'm
like.
I'm not that funny when I'm bitter.
Like, maybe not when you're bitter, but I just mean
people
craggy.
But that's what you're saying when you start. Kind of poking people like that, you know how to do it instinctively. So like there is that moment where it's funny, but it's sort of like that was a little much.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was always good at the little much.
Me, thank you.
So you hurt people,
and it sucked. And
so after,
but I didn't have that many. I can't think of any other real times in my life where something. I think I'm using the wrong term, but changed on a dime. Like, I was literally craggy, angry, not happy for people. And the next day, I had rainbow shooting out my asshole. I was like,
after she called you out,
it was like a new, it was like a film lifted off my eyes.
But what was the American Idol experience that you just didn't, you lost?
It was another, epic high and epic low. Where they 118,000 people tried out that year, and I made the top 36.
Yeah,
but instead of doing a top 24 and then one person going home each week, they did a top 36 and then they sent 24 people home at once and went directly to a top 12. So I was in that massive chunk of people that went home.
Ugh.
It was all, but I had given at that point. I auditioned for it in August. And I didn't go home until March. And I was like sequestered. And I was like in another planet for 8 months. And then they owned me from the March, from the date of my live show, for 12 months.
Yeah.
So I was owned by American Idol for 18 months. What at the time felt like nothing. But I'll tell you something. More weird, little, fun, magical shit has come from that than you can imagine. Like, I'm still on meetings. And like this, some guy that runs some enormous company was like, you're here because your name came across my desk. And I loved you on Idol. And we couldn't do anything with your mouth on like, it was a singing competition. And you were like roasting Seacrest to his face. And he didn't notice. We had to edit everything out. And I knew at the time, like, this fucking kid. And then you got on Glow and that was fun. And now you're here and up for this other thing. But this guy was like a PA editor, low level guy on American Idol.
That's hilarious.
Who remembered me all that. So it's like these weird little.
Sure. You've hung in there. So everything changed. You became a good person. That friend is still your friend?
Yeah, she's one of my best friends still. Let's shout her out. Her name's Faye Wolf.
Yeah.
And she's a beautiful musician.
So from that point on. What, that's when you start focusing on music more and doing comedy?
Comedy, actually. Yeah. I, at that similar time, my friend, also great name, Jess Saddleberger, we would always do bits and she was like, why don't you do stand up? And I was like, speaking of telling yourself stories, I'd always dated stand up comics.
I know you went out with Kyle.
Yes. Yeah. Kyle Dunnigan. I'd always dated comics and I was like, I don't know, it feels really negative. It feels really like it's not.
You're a real born again love person.
I was like, well, it just didn't feel like a happy thing to do. Uh-huh. I wasn't even born again lovey. What I was doing was telling myself stories and giving myself what seemed like rational excuses to not do the thing I should so fucking clearly do.
Oh, yeah.
That I was scared of.
Right.
So instead of being like, I'm scared and I have to start from the beginning.
Who the fuck says that?
So I was like, I don't know. It's negative. It's dark in there. I was at this club the other night and I would use some comic's name that I saw who was like so drunk, which is true. So drunk, passed out on the bar.
Yeah.
And like people were fans of his and he would just like lift his head and be like, bruv. And then somehow he'd get on stage and do a perfectly cogent set.
And you were like that's not for you.
And I was like, no, this is, but again, that didn't have to be my experience. I was just writing this story to keep my heart safe so I didn't get hurt by trying to do stand-up and failing or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And so she was like, you really should do it. And then I joined this writer's group, this like stand-up writer's group where you get together with 10 comics.
Yeah.
And you just go up in a mic at a mic and like in this room and then people just pitch each other jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it became so positive and so community and so loving so fucking cool. And that was when, and there I was doing stand up. And then people in that group were like coming to see me do sort of straight music.
Yeah.
And they were like, how are you not doing musical comedy? And I was like, I don't know, because I kind of roll my eyes at it.
Right.
I kind of was like, I don't really, when I see a comic with a guitar, I'm like, okay, let's see this hacky bullshit. But then you look at Jack Black and you don't feel that way, or you look at when Adam Sandler does it, and there's ways to do it that are not.
If you don't do parody.
Yeah, and I don't.
Right.
And I don't, and I
know you open for me.
So,
that's fun.
I'll do that anytime. I love it. And that crowd was so delightful.
They're nice.
Damn it. And so then I started doing musical comedy, and then it was like, oh, this is, not only is it this cool, unique thing that separates you from everybody else, but it just so. It's so just clicked.
Yeah.
And now that's pretty much my jam. I hardly do any straight stand-up anymore.
Sure.
Just schlep that guitar around. So what happened was I because of Glow, and then I'm making this animated preschool musical series with Kristen Bell. It's called Do Re and Me.
Oh, yeah.
And we're these, it's three singing birds who are best friends who go on this musical adventure every episode. And we're doing a 52-episode first season. And so, and I'm... EPing it, and I'm writing all the music for it and voicing it. And so I'm not the thing that had to take a back seat currently while making this show was not going to the store or the improv and like, right. trying to do two shows a night. So that part of it, it was the one thing I could go like, okay, that can take a back seat today.
Sure.
For now.
Yeah.
Cause I can't, it's just, cause it's also such a nighttime game. And I've got shit to do.
Well, I mean, but that's exciting, doing animated stuff and writing original music for it and characters.
Hell yeah.
So that's the thing you're doing now in GLOW. We're just sort of waiting on GLOW.
We're waiting on GLOW.
And you're great on GLOW. We've had a good time.
You're great on GLOW.
You don't annoy me as much.
Yeah, it's true. You don't annoy
me. We love each other.
I love you so much. Yeah. You don't annoy me as much either. You never actually annoyed me.
How could I annoy you? You're the annoying one.
That's crazy. And that's,
how is that crazy?
It's true that I'm the annoying one. I don't deny that. But you're the craggy one.
Okay.
So you don't annoy me, but you're like, you know, I'll be avoidant.
Uh-huh.
I think it's an interesting thing with you because I don't know if you're going to, like, when I see you, if I'm going to get a hug, a head nod, or be treated like the person with the fucking petition outside Whole Foods.
Yeah.
Like, I never know what, like, what's Maren going to do? Hug me? Give me a head nod?
I know. Okay. I need some consistency. Like, it shouldn't be that kind of, you shouldn't have to feel that just because it's only based on my day.
Right. But it's not like I don't feel the good news about that is that I do care because I love you, but I don't feel like fear or negativity around it.
It doesn't have anything
I
to
just
do with
go
you.
Like, yeah. I don't know what this is going to be.
All right.
I like to tell the story really quick before I go that when I, season one, when I would see you in the morning, I'd go, hi, Mark. And you'd go, it's a lot. And all I did was say, hi, Mark. And I'd say to you, you know, in the time it took you to say it's a lot, you could have just said good morning, you fuck. And then I would walk. That was like our first interaction ever.
It's a boundary thing. I love you.
I love you.
All right. Are we good? Are we done?
It's up to you. It's your show. And I'm so fucking happy to be here. Thank you for having me,
I think we covered a lot of stuff.
We did. And we're done.
That was Jackie Tone and me talking like we talk. GLOW is on, streaming on Netflix, 3 seasons. We'll be back again next year. And now I will play some droning guitar for you. I saw Hank! Boomer lives.